As of July 1st, 2025, applications are open for the Thomistic Institute's Rome Study Abroad program for spring 2026. Immerse yourself in the Catholic intellectual tradition and experience profound opportunities for spiritual formation in the heart of the Church. Applications close August 15th. Learn more and apply at www.thomisticinstitute.org/Rome.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
What makes laws just? An introduction to the natural law tradition. This is the theme that I was asked to speak on, and in inviting me, the organizers said, now, we would like something that introduces the natural law tradition, but not too introductory because there are some people who really know the subject. So I tried to make this a kind of a blend. So this talk will have some parts that are, I think, rather introductory, like for someone who maybe doesn't know much about this subject at all. And then other parts where I'm going to try to like go a little higher and hopefully in a way that's sufficiently clear that you will be able to follow it even if you are not very familiar with it. So I'm going to try to find the just mean, the golden mean, which Aristotle says is where you find virtue. The subject of justice is complex. And as both Plato and Aristotle suggested, in speaking about justice, we are in a certain sense speaking of the whole of the moral or ethical life. So it's a huge subject to talk about justice. It's also a huge subject and very fraught to talk about natural law, especially in, say, the American constitutional tradition. So we cannot hope to do this subject justice in this brief session, but we can try to do what we can. There's often great difficulty today, I think, in connecting the study of law and politics with more general considerations of justice. And many of us do have rather strong views about what is just and what is unjust, but that doesn't always translate easily into the complex world of public policy, and certainly not necessarily into black letter law if you're studying in law school. So what I would like to do is bring to bear on these big questions some of the classic resources of the Western tradition. And some of those classic sources give us a lot of help. If we go back to St. Thomas Aquinas, who I think is one of the great expositors of this tradition and who is the touchstone for the Thomistic Institute, of which I am the director, I think we find something very powerful. So there'll be a lot of Thomas Aquinas in this talk, but not only Aquinas. I hope that a lot of what you hear will already be at least a little bit familiar. But I think in general, what's happened is that the moral tradition that has come to us from, say, the ancient world through the great medieval synthesis of Thomas Aquinas and others has become fragmented, even though many parts of it still remain familiar to us. But it's fragmented in such a way that the terms don't always mean exactly what they meant for previous figures, and how it all fits together is not always that clear to us in a way that it was clear previously. So what I hope at least we will be able to do is identify some of the key elements and show how, for like Aquinas, these all fit together in a harmonious synthetic whole. And if you start grasping the whole, then you have made a huge step forward in understanding. You can always go deeper in the individual pieces. We're not going to be able to explore all of them. Okay, this talk is not a religious talk. I will sometimes mention God. But Aquinas, and I think the Western tradition more generally, thinks that simply mentioning the word God does not make something religious. We can know that there is some uncaused cause of the universe just from the reflection of philosophical reason. And so I think we can also talk about how there are natural principles of justice that have some foundation in the first creation of a contingent world from a necessary and eternal creator. And that's the only sense in which this talk will be religious. It's not going to be based on divine revelation. And whenever I bring something up that deals with, say, Christianity in particular, I will flag that for you. Okay, so what makes a law just? Now, one answer is, a law is just when it is duly enacted by the proper legal authority. Another and similar answer would be, well, a law is just when it follows constitutional norms, or maybe when the U.S. Supreme Court adjudicates the claims and determines what the constitutional answer is. But I think that can't be quite right. And there's many examples that we could use to illustrate that. One example, often cited, would be the Nuremberg trials after World War II, when certain officials of the German government were tried and convicted and punished for acts that, under the law of Germany in the 1930s and 1940s, were authorized by the law. And you could ask, how is it just to try someone for a crime that was not recognized as a crime by the prevailing norms of the duly constituted government in that region? And that's a very good question. Would it be unjust to condemn someone who, for example, organized the systematic killing of innocents who had not been tried and convicted of a crime? That was like one of the things that these people who were condemned by the Nuremberg trials were charged with and convicted of. There's another example from our own legal tradition, our own history here in the United States. Think of Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. How many of you have read that or read parts of it? Many of you are familiar with it. We could go through it if we had time, but I think in the interest of time, I'll just give you the very short summary, which probably you know. Birmingham, Alabama had a system of racial segregation. Martin Luther King protested against that. He was arrested and imprisoned, and he wrote this letter from a jail appealing to the conscience, first of all, of Christian ministers, but really to a much wider audience, arguing that these laws were unjust, even though they had been duly passed by the legislature and, by the way, also under the reigning standards of constitutional law at that point, were constitutional. Now, later, the Supreme Court would declare them unconstitutional. But when Martin Luther King was imprisoned, they were completely constitutional, or at least they were arguably constitutional. And the regime, you know, you might say the regime in Birmingham, Alabama, were acting completely according to the norms of the positive law. He said in his letter, remember that everything Hitler did in Germany was legal. And everything the Hungarian freedom fighters did in Hungary, this was the spring uprising in Hungary, everything they did against the totalitarian communist regime was illegal. He's making a strong objection there to a view that legal positivism would put forward, which is that the only way you can judge the legitimacy of a law is by asking whether it is duly enacted, effectively, by the proper authority. So legal positivism thinks that whatever the duly constituted governing authority decrees is binding. And on this view, any kind of claim about a higher law or an unwritten law or a moral law or a natural law is too vague to consider. And it certainly really can't be called a law. So natural law is only law in quotes on that kind of view. And so, the question of whether a law is just in accord with the natural law is really an unimportant or maybe unanswerable question. Thomas Aquinas does think that there is a way to consider the justice of a positive law, and that we can make reference to higher norms. And he's an expositor of an understanding of natural law, not only natural law. And what I want to do is kind of outline his answer to this question: what makes laws just? Before, though, we can talk about the relationship between law and justice and how they're connected, I think we have to clarify for a moment, at least, probably a few moments, what is justice? Okay, so that's where I'd like to go next. What is justice? And then we're going to talk about what is a law in a little bit, and then what is natural law for Aquinas. In his most famous treatment of the subject, in his Summa Theologiae, his great work, St. Thomas Aquinas doesn't principally treat justice as an abstract concept. He treats it in his section on the virtues, and he gives this definition of justice as a virtue. He says, justice is the virtue, the habitus, by which one renders to each his due by a constant and perpetual will. Okay, you render to each what is due. And the word there in Latin is jus. Jus, sometimes it's spelled with a J, but it's in medieval Latin, J and I are really the same letter. So jus, the due, what is due to another. So his definition refers to this object of justice. Now, English translators often translate jus as right, but it also could be translated as the just, or what is due, or even as law. You could even say what is fair would be a way of translating jus. It's kind of a difficult concept to just translate because there's no single English word that quite captures all of its nuances. It's drawn from the Roman legal tradition, and it's a great example of how Aquinas is drawing from a background tradition, in that case, a pagan tradition, and synthesizes Aristotle and Roman and Christian, say, St. Augustine, traditions on law. Okay, so what is this jus, this due, or this right? It's a key question. So Aquinas investigates this, if you're interested, in the second part of the Summa, the Secunda Secundae, question 57. And there he says, justice has the jus as its object. And he makes several distinctive claims about justice based on this idea of what is due or what is right. Okay, the first is, it is with respect to another. Okay, so you are not just with respect to yourself. Justice is about giving what is due to another. And that's actually an interesting point. You're not just to your hands or your feet. They're just part of you. But you are just with respect to someone else. So justice regulates our relations with others. Okay, very simple point, but helpful. Okay, this then leads Aquinas to note how justice is different from other moral virtues. Other moral virtues, think of, for example, temperance or courage. That's about something in you. It qualifies you. Justice is about your relationship with other people. And so in a certain sense, the standard of justice is outside of you. And it has a certain objective character. It's not so much based on the kind of person you are. What you owe to another is not so much based on the kind of person you are. It's based on something outside of you. Do you see the point? So there's something out there about justice. That's a second key aspect. It's, in a sense, independent of the person acting. It's something that we all must recognize as outside of us and calling us to do something or to respect something. Okay, third point. Justice has to do with a kind of equality in some sense. It presupposes that you have at least two parties, and we're trying to find what is due between them or what is fair between them. It implies a certain equality between the parties, at least on some sense. Now, you can go a little deeper into this, and we could explore this if you want to talk about it more. It's a very interesting feature. For Aquinas, our common human nature is the foundation of the fact that we have obligations of justice to other human beings. And that's the ground of our equality. And actually, the Declaration of Independence also starts here and grounds our rights vis-a-vis each other and vis-a-vis our government in that common human nature. You remember the line, all men are created equal, right? So it's calling on the fact that we are all equally creatures under God. And that's very explicit in the Declaration of Independence as the grounding for the most fundamental claims that our American political regime is based on. More specifically for Aquinas, it's not just that we're human, it's that we are rational animals, individuals of a rational nature. So that grounds our equality with justice. There's something about being rational, having a spiritual soul, having a mind that is able to grasp the truth and grasp what is good, that creates the obligations owed to others in justice, and also the expectation that others will behave in justice towards us. Aquinas comes at this from the perspective of the capacity for the human being for rational action. So human beings are unique among all of the visible creatures because we possess ourselves. We direct ourselves by the use of our minds, by the use of our reason and our choices. We are not just moved by force, like a stone, or by a purely vegetative power, like a tree growing out of the ground, and not even by external stimuli, like a lion pursuing the gazelle. Rather, we move ourselves by rational reflection and free choice. And that is unique. So philosophically speaking, for Aquinas, this is what grounds the equality of justice between human beings. Now, he thinks it's possible to speak about justice metaphorically when we're dealing with non-rational creatures. But he thinks this is not justice in the proper sense. So, properly speaking, you cannot complain against your dog when your dog jumps up on the counter while you're out of the room and eats your dinner, right? Has that ever happened to you? It does sometimes happen, right? And you come back and you're like, what did you do, right? The dog just was being a dog, right? You don't complain. I mean, you might be upset if you had a pet sheep, for example, and a wolf broke in and ate the sheep. But animals don't make claims in justice against each other. They simply act, and the stronger gets the better portion, right? A stronger predator takes the carcass. Even if a weaker predator killed the gazelle, the stronger lion will take it. And the stronger lion doesn't say, well, you know, I probably shouldn't eat that gazelle because after all, the other guy did kill it. But human beings do that. And this grounds our relationship of justice. Now, also properly speaking, Aquinas would say, you can't really be unjust to an animal in the same way you can be unjust to a human being. That's interesting. We could talk more about that. He does think there's a sense in which you can be unjust by treating things in nature not according to their nature, by abusing them. But it doesn't create the same kind of debt of justice that you owe to a human being, on his view. Now, because all human beings are equal precisely as rational animals, for Aquinas, as self-governing actors, and also as creatures under God, Aquinas thinks that justice does not only obtain between citizens of the same city or members of the same political society, but in fact, between all human beings. Now, this is interesting. This is actually different from Aristotle. Aristotle really thought more along the lines of like classic pagan antiquity that your political community created the realm of justice. And outside of your political community, you could, you know, that was the Wild West out there, right? It's the barbarians are outside. And you do not owe them justice in the same way you owe justice to your fellow citizens in the city. But Aquinas actually sees this really, now here's where kind of a theological dimension comes into Aquinas' account, because he sees us all as equally creatures of God, but also equally potential members of the body of Christ. So we belong to each other in a higher way because of this supernatural dimension that God has revealed to us in Christianity. Okay, fourth point. We're almost done with this section. Justice is pointing for Aquinas to something that is real. It isn't just an idea or a theory. It's a reality that arises from the nature of things, and especially the nature of human beings, from the fact that they are naturally in relation with each other because of the kind of things that they are. Okay, so for Aquinas then, the jus, or what is due to another, the object of justice, depends on the fact that we are rational creatures, each of us, and that we find ourselves inhabiting the same created order under God. And in fact, if we wanted to be really ambitious in this talk, we could try to explore that wider framework of order. This is actually extremely important for Aquinas on the natural law, that all of creation comes forth from God, and each thing in creation is related to God as its cause and also as its final end, and likewise is related to the other things in creation according to the ordered plan that God has for the cosmos. So we could try to get into all of that. That's a very big theological or philosophical picture, but we can be a little more modest too, and I think that's enough for what for our purposes here, which is, let's just look at the order among human beings, in human society. Aquinas would say, listen, each of us is a member of various ordered wholes. We're born into them. We necessarily belong to them because of the nature of human beings as social animals, political animals, rational animals. So you're born into a family, a neighborhood, a political or civil society, and more widely, the whole human race, or Augustine would say, the city of God, the whole body of Christ. Okay, you're born into that. And you always exist in some set of relationships that you did not choose and that simply structure your existence in a way. Since justice is a relational order, a relational concept about your place in this order, what is due, then you begin to understand how the structure of that order tells us a lot about, in fact, what is due. So Aquinas would have an account of what is due to your parents, which is different from what is due to your siblings, because of the place in the order that you have. What is due to your next door neighbor is different, perhaps, from what is due to the President of the United States or to someone who lives on the other side of the globe. Something about the relation that you have to others will shape what is due to them. Now, this is quite different from accounts of justice that are derived from social contract theory. And that's probably something you're very familiar with. You might think of theories like Thomas Hobbes or John Locke or even John Rawls, which tend to abstract from the concrete historical relationships that we all are born into and try to come up with a much more abstracted and theoretical account of like where obligations in justice come from, say based on a social contract theory. But that is not Aquinas's theory. Aquinas thinks that you simply are always born into a set of relationships and with other rational creatures, and therefore there are things that you owe them and things that they owe you in virtue of your place in this wider order. And likewise, there are things that you owe the society that you belong to and the ruler of that society, and there are things that you owe to God. All of those things are not matters of choice. They're simply features of reality that we inhabit. Okay, now I'd like to talk for a minute about natural law. Given this basic introduction to what is justice, what then makes a law just? And part of Aquinas's answer will be to speak about natural law. And sometimes this gets very abstract and confusing to people, but actually for Aquinas, it's very simple and straightforward. It's a very straightforward idea. And I'd like to try to illustrate it with some examples, which I think are hopefully easily understood. So a friend of mine was raised on an apple farm. And suppose you were to wake up one day and discover that you're in charge of an apple farm. So what is your goal? Your goal is to raise good apples. You want them to taste good, to look good, to be sufficiently durable. You want your trees to yield a sufficient crop every year, and so forth. Okay, so what are you going to do to run this apple farm well? You're going to begin to pay attention to what makes the trees flourish and produce the kind of apples you're after, right? You might experiment over time with different ways of pruning the trees or fertilizing them. You might try harvesting the apples at different times. You might see if different varieties of apple trees work better for this climate or that climate. And you will end up with a kind of set of practical wisdom, do's and don'ts, for raising good apples. And in fact, my friend who was raised on an apple farm learned these things from his parents, who had learned them from their parents because their family for generations had run an apple farm in rural Illinois. And he can tell you all about apples, and he's decided he doesn't want to have anything to do with apples. So he's become a Dominican, and he burned the hoe that he used as a child as like a symbolic act to renounce his heritage of apple farming. Okay, but he has this practical wisdom about apples. Okay, suppose we change the example and now talk about, say, raising show jumping horses. Okay, show jumping horses are much more sophisticated things than apples, because not only do you have to pay attention to what makes the horse like healthy, but now you have to train the horse. You have to train the horse to be noble and to do things that are possible for the horse, but you have to like work at it to bring out this dimension of the nobility of the horse. But a beautifully executed show jumping routine is actually really impressive. And it's showing you something that is potential in the horse that the training and the practical wisdom is bringing out, that kind of education. So a horse trainer has a lot of practical wisdom about how to raise good horses. Now, you can think about this in lots of different ways, and you can come up with rules for good apples or rules for training show jumping horses. It's like a list of things that you ought to do if you want to have, say, good show jumping horses. The normal sort of human activity to think about things this way. Okay, what does that have to do with law? Well, what if we're trying to have good human beings? What if we're trying to have a good human society? Like a functioning city? Are there some rules of thumb that we would say, yeah, you got to pay attention to those if you want your city to work well? And that might sound like very functionalist, but in fact, it's just this kind of reasoning that give rise to the natural law tradition. Because we start looking around and saying, okay, what kind of beings are human beings? We're rational beings. We're animals, but we're rational animals. So we care about things like truth. So if someone is systematically lying to you, it ruins your relationship with them. You cannot have a good relationship unless it's based on some kind of communion in the truth. We don't want to face threats to our continued existence. You know, we need a certain amount of basic security. So like your life has to be safeguarded. Your possessions need to be safeguarded. But we can go further and say, you know, we want to have friendships. Like human life without friendships is wretched. So we need to have the kind of society where it's possible to have real friendships. And beyond that, human beings care about knowing the highest things. So a place where we can know the truth, not only, you know, facts, but know something about what our life means. Like, this is very important to human beings. Justice is very important to human beings. No one wants to live in a city where there is rampant injustice. So these are real features of what makes a human city or a human society flourish, what makes human beings flourish. And if we look at the kind of creatures we are, we can come up with a kind of shorthand or practical wisdom about what is necessary. Now, Aquinas thinks that you can start from that and go much deeper to understand that, in fact, this is a feature of human beings as creatures under God. We can begin to understand something of God's plan for human beings as we reflect on the kind of creatures we are. And that leads us to certain fundamental rules or precepts that we can say are always the case in any human society if you're going to have a good society, a functioning society. And those would be precepts of the natural law for Aquinas. Okay, let me now move to the third part of the talk, which is about the definition of law. So here's where we can begin to answer what makes a law just. Aquinas has a famous definition of law. He says, law is an ordination of reason for the common good made by one with care of the community, which is promulgated. Okay, four elements. Ordination of reason, for the common good, made by one who has care of the community, and promulgated. Okay, so first, the law aims at a good, the common good. Okay, the law aims at the good of the human community. It's like aiming at the good of the apple tree or the good of the show horses, but the human community is vastly more complex than this. Law is intrinsically ordered to setting us up to achieve that good. Okay, secondly, for Aquinas, law is an ordination of reason concerning the common good. Okay, why is that? That's because we as human beings have the capacity to observe and understand the world around us, to use our minds to direct our activity. Law arises when someone with the care of the community publicly promulgates an ordination of reason that directs the community towards its good. So we're using our minds, and especially the one with care of the community, is using the power of reason to assess and direct the community towards its good. That's Aquinas's understanding of law. So what is very interesting about this definition of law, and I think very significant and different from most or many modern conceptions? Law is not about commanding other people to do things. That's the first point. Secondly, law is not about imposing moral obligations on other people. Law is not about some kind of coercion. Law is not an exercise of will or of power. Law is an ordination of reason directing the community to its good. Okay, that's a very powerful idea of the law, and it's a very important one with lots of implications. Because then, for Aquinas, law is not intrinsically coercive. Rather, it is directive towards an end. It is perfective. So, in the U.S., sometimes we have the mentality like freedom versus law. We would sort of like to, you know, think that if we could just unshackle ourselves from all these laws, then things would be great, you know? Like, I'm being constrained by all these rules being piled on top of me. And those rules are suppressing my ability to do whatever I want, to seek the goods that I want. Aquinas does not have that view at all. He thinks that law is actually essential to you obtaining your good, and more specifically, your good as a part of the wider community. Because, after all, the common good is also your good. It's just a good of a nobler and higher type. So just as a good sports coach will give like laws to his team to help them achieve victory, and winning the victory is a good for every member of the team, so it equally belongs to all the members of the team, so the common good belongs equally to us all. And the function of law is to help us order ourselves communally to achieve that good by the power of reason. What then is the function, what then is the natural law for Aquinas? The natural law is, he says, our participation in God's eternal law, by which he means God's plan for the whole of creation. God has created an ordered whole, and that ordered whole, all the things in it, are moving towards their ultimate good. What is their, in the end of the story for Aquinas, what is the highest good for every created thing? It is God himself. So that's actually part of God's plan. God wants all things to reach their perfection, reach their greatest happiness. And he has an ordered plan of wisdom by which he's created all things and moves them towards their ends. Human beings have the capacity to understand the world that we live in and what we are made for, what is really good for us as human beings, and to direct ourselves towards that good by coming up with these rules of practical wisdom, you might say, for a happy human life or a happy human community. And that's what the natural law is. It is us taking an appraisal of the real world that we inhabit and understanding the features of it that point us to the necessary elements that we have to have for a human community to be happy and to flourish, to be good. Okay, what then is the function of the positive law for Aquinas? There's an enormous diversity of human cultures and a wide range of different situations that human cultures exist in. So positive law exists so that a particular community can make much more concrete determinations about how to achieve its good in its particular circumstances. And it will always need to respect the fundamental truths about what human beings are. For example, like that killing innocents is wrong, so, you know, destroying life, or that being untruthful is wrong. Like, those things are aspects of the natural law for Aquinas, always true. But the human positive law is the opportunity for an individual human society, a particular one, to make further determinations about how it's going to achieve its good. So the positive law turns out to be actually really important for human society because it makes very concrete decisions about how this community is going to move forward. What then is the relationship between positive law and the natural law? Well, it's very simple. Aquinas thinks the natural law is pretty generic. It gives us just rather general rules or guidelines, you might say. Well, stronger than guidelines. He thinks that they're laws that positive law must always respect. But they don't. The natural law is not going to answer every question, and it exists at a rather high level of generality. The positive law simply must not transgress the rules set by the natural law. But it's going to have a lot of things in it that the natural law doesn't contain. And in fact, this was the argument of Martin Luther King. This also was the argument that was made by the prosecutors at the Nuremberg trials. So when a positive law directly contravenes some fundamental precept of the natural law, you can judge that the positive law is unjust. And there's a long tradition saying an unjust law of that kind does not bind you. And in fact, you may be morally warranted or even obligated to disobey that positive law. So to take the Nazi example, the decision that certain people should be killed without trial in concentration camps contravenes the fundamental principle of the protection of human life, innocent human life. Killing an innocent human life is always wrong. Directly killing an innocent human life is always wrong. And the natural law is makes that clear and is knowable to everyone that that's unjust. So a human positive law that commands that or permits that is an unjust law on that account. And that's basically what the Nuremberg trials stood for. Likewise, Martin Luther King was saying a system of law that fundamentally discriminates based on someone's race is fundamentally unjust because this is not a basis for inequality between human beings. And so he made this very strong and I think true, noble appeal to the conscience of Americans to overturn and get rid of those laws. Okay, let me conclude then by kind of summarizing what I take to be Aquinas' account of the relationship between law and justice. So we've seen law is an ordination of reason directed to the common good. And that means then that law is a teacher about what is good for human beings and the human community. Laws guide us to move towards and achieve that good. And that's why unjust laws are so dangerous. They not only result in injustice in a particular case, but they also deform our community, teaching us that what is wrong is right. And that makes us morally deformed, or to put it otherwise, bad. Many people don't want to admit that the law is a teacher in this way. And it's kind of a controversial proposition to say law is a moral teacher. Like, should the law legislate morality? Most people immediately react against that. And they think that what we're talking about is maybe a Baptist preacher with a Bible who's going to thump everyone over the head who is not following the rules for human sexuality that he thinks are the Christian moral norms, right? Most people immediately go to thinking about sex when you say, should the law enact morality? But Aquinas has a much broader view, and he thinks every law is making a moral claim. Every law, and that's because a moral claim is about what is good. So every law is ordering the community towards some good. I think you could even rightly defend the proposition that you cannot come up with an example of a law that does not have a moral dimension in this sense that the law is ordering the community towards some good, at least a perceived good. So there's lots of room in Aquinas' theory for different communities to come up with very different ways of ordering themselves to the good. But he thinks there will always remain certain things that are inconsistent with the human good because of the nature of human beings and of human society. The nature of human beings as created by God and under God. And that fundamentally is what constrains the positive law and is a kind of standard, sometimes a somewhat minimal standard, about what makes a law just. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.